Good day. Today is Saturday, 25th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, yesterday, as I was making the programme, news was trickling in of a Russian missile strike on Kiev, and there were many reports of 10 Iskander-M ballistic missiles being used and of 10 Tsarkon hypersonic missiles being used. But the reality turned out to be quite different and in some ways more interesting, because apparently what the Russians were hitting, were striking at, was an arms show that was taking place in a village to the north of Kiev in the Bucha area. And according to most of the reports, there were various trade officials there, military people, scientists, engineers, and the items that were being displayed were items from the various menagerie of drones which Ukraine possesses. And incredibly, the event had been publicized in the Ukrainian media, so of course the Russians knew all about it. The location in the advanced publicity was not provided, but of course Russian military intelligence had no difficulty working out where this event was taking place. And as the event took place, with the media, apparently the Ukrainian media present, a Russian missile or missiles struck the meeting. 10 people were killed, according to the Ukrainians. Some are saying that the numbers were greater, and a lot of the exhibition space and the items that were being shown in the exhibition were destroyed. And incidentally, there are reports that the missile used was neither a Iskander nor a Tsarkon, and that only one missile was used, and that it was a new type of missile of a type that the Russians have not used before or not disclosed before. Personally, I wonder whether the strike was carried out by drones, or whether possibly Geran drones, maybe the new Geran 5 drones, about which we're hearing very little, but which apparently have very advanced engines and which can fly, it seems, at high altitudes and are quite stealthy. Or whether, if it was a missile or missiles, whether the attack was made by the new Banderol missiles that the Russians have and which are carried by Orion drones, the Russian equivalent of the Predator and Raptor drones that the United States has. Anyway, I'm not going to speculate further about that because, of course, I simply don't know. But it was just a very embarrassing episode for Ukraine. Zelensky is said to be livid and furious about it. He has complained bitterly to the various security services for the fact that news of the exhibition was leaked in advance. As I said previously, this is not the first thing that has happened. And a criminal investigation is now being organised, presumably to investigate the organisers, though in Ukraine the organisers, whoever they are certain to be extremely well-connected people, and I don't expect this investigation to go anywhere at all. There may be something else that made Zelensky extremely angry yesterday. I have discussed in several programs Ukraine's attack on the Caspian Sea, on the Caspian Pipeline Consortium terminal in the Black Sea. The fact that after that attack, Kazakhstan made a very, very strong protest, which Russia supported, and that Kazakhstan has suspended operation from this particular terminal, with the result that Romania is now suffering a potential fuel shortage because Romania imports most of its oil from Kazakhstan. Anyway, the other thing is that the Caspian Pipeline Consortium includes an important American oil company, Chevron to be precise, and must therefore be judged an attack on an American economic asset. Anyway, it seems that Mike Wirth, the CEO of Chevron, has gone to Washington and has been complaining loudly about the Ukrainian attacks on the ships that were unloading oil at the terminal and the attacks on the terminal itself. And according to some claims, this has gone all the way up to Donald Trump himself. But whether or not that is true, the Wall Street Journal says that the administration altogether is angry about this attack. They regard the attack on the terminal as indeed being an attack on an important strategic asset. But they're also angry that an attack has been made on an alternative supply route for oil to Europe and to the rest of the world at the time of an energy shortage. And it seems that the White House, the Trump administration, has told Zelensky that this must never happen again. Now, Zelensky has often been on the receiving end of these sort of demands from his American sponsors. The invariable pattern of behavior is he becomes sulky and angry and complains about what the Americans are doing to his European and American friends, and he has plenty of American friends. And eventually, he just goes back to doing that which the Americans told him to stop doing and ignores the demand from the Americans that he stop. And the administration, whichever it is, simply folds. So in 2024, Ukraine began its attacks on Russian oil refineries. The Biden administration, worried about the effect on the price of oil in advance of the November 2024 election, told Zelensky to stop. Zelensky just went ahead and continued to do it, paying no attention to what the Biden administration was telling him. And I see no reason to assume that this time it's going to be any different. But knowing Zelensky and knowing the way that he behaves, all of this is going to have put him in an extremely bad mood altogether. And it can't have improved his mood in relation to the attack on the exhibition that took place outside Kiev. Anyway, that's that particular episode that took place yesterday. There were more strikes between the Russians and the Ukrainians last night. The Ukrainians made another massive effort to deal damage, to inflict damage upon Russia. There was a massive drone strike which encompassed Belgorod, the city of Belgorod, which is close to the Ukrainian border. Apparently, Belgorod doesn't just get attacked by Ukrainian drones, but Ukrainian multiple launch rocket systems, Vampire systems, originally supplied by the Czech Republic, are particularly busy in these attacks, are also involved in these attacks. But anyway, there was an attack on Belgorod. Then there was a further attempt to strike, perhaps by the same drone swarm, at the Engels Air Base near Saratov. Reports say that none of the drones actually managed to hit the air base. All of the drones that tried were shot down. A drone or drones did attack an old and apparently unused headquarters. I say apparently, I mean, I don't know, but that's what I've heard. Unused former headquarters of the Russian, used by the Russian Air Force in Saratov. Presumably, this was a relocation of the drones, a redirection of the drones away from the airbase, as it became clear that the air defences were impenetrable. And then there was a further attempt by the drones, which then continued to fly deeper into Russia. They flew towards the Urals, and they attempted to attack another Wildberries warehouse, this time in Yekaterinburg, the big Russian city in the Urals, the biggest Russian city in the Urals, a major industrial and economic hub, incidentally. But anyway, there was an attempt to attack the Wildberries warehouse there. And for a time, reports circulated that the warehouse had indeed been attacked and destroyed until a footage, video footage of the attack appeared, which showed the drone being shot down, the drone that attempted to attack the warehouse being shot down by the Russian air defense and crashing on the nearby car park. And it was damage to the car park that created the smoke that people mistakenly believed was the attack on the warehouse. And then at least some drones moved further east beyond the Urals to the Siberian city of Tyumen, which is a major center of the Russian oil industry, and attempted to attack the Tyumen oil refinery, which has been the subject of several Ukrainian attacks in the past. Video footage has appeared showing two columns of smoke rising from the refinery, but the smoke columns seem to me to be small. So presumably, if the drones did strike anything, the damage that would have been done, to what I understand is an enormous facility, would have been relatively limited. So anyway, that's the story of last night's Ukrainian strike. Hundreds of drones again used in an attack. The Russians also claimed that there were drone attacks on all sorts of other regions of Russia, and also, by the way, on the Sea of Azov. There's no word of any shipping, Russian shipping, being damaged in the Sea of Azov or on the Black Sea, which makes me think that Russian air defense is now working increasingly effectively. So Well, you can judge for yourself, but putting aside the damage done to Belgorod, which is real, but it is a frontline city which has suffered regular attack and damage since the start of the Ukrainian cross-border attacks into Russia, which began in 2023. Well, putting all that aside, given the quantity of drones used, given the enormous effort that has gone into this drone attack inside Russia, it doesn't seem to me as if very much was achieved overall at all. Certainly not enough that would justify the amount of time, energy, and resources it would have taken to organize this strike. At least that is my own personal view. Now, the Russians, for their part, continued their devastating strikes on Odessa. These continued relentlessly last night. Not a day or a night passes without further Russian strikes on Odessa. And the Russians continued their methodical destruction of gasoline filling stations in central and eastern Ukraine. The numbers that they have now destroyed run into the hundreds, though I would be suspicious of any totals that people put forward. Now, what I find difficult to understand is why these Ukrainian drone attacks against Russia, targets inside Russia, continue to get quite the level of attention that they do, whereas the Russian combined missile and drone attacks on Odessa, by contrast, and not just Odessa, but the other Ukrainian ports on the Black Sea, why those strikes get so little attention in the Western media at all. I was looking at the British media this morning, and they don't mention the strikes on Ukraine's Black Sea coast at all. Now, whatever damage the Ukrainians have done to the Russian refinery complex has not created an economic crisis in Russia. On the contrary, the latest reports continue to speak of a general stabilization of the fuel situation inside at least pre-2014 Russia and of the beginnings of decline in fuel prices. The Russian Central Bank has registered the fall in Russian fuel prices and has given this as one of its reasons for reducing interest rates, Russian interest rates, by a further 25 basis points, which it did the day before yesterday. And reports, by the way, speak of a general upswing in the Russian economy in June, which apparently have been strengthening this July, that industrial activity in particular has expanded, though obviously only to the extent that it can, in a framework still set by the very high interest rates imposed by the Russian Central Bank. So, my point is, however, that the refinery attacks have caused anger and inconvenience, but they have not precipitated a political crisis, and they don't seem to be affecting the situation in the Russian economy overall. On the contrary, we're talking about what the fuel energy complex has been doing in Russia. The reports speak of very high export demand for Russian oil, of the Russians now busy supplying oil to India and China in near record quantities, of all of the big Indian refineries now buying Russian oil, and of the big Chinese refineries having now taken their cue from the Chinese government, which told them to ignore any American warnings of secondary sanctions, of the big Chinese refineries now also rushing to buy Russian oil. There are reports that that as ships, tankers are loaded with oil in Russia's far eastern ports, the Chinese refineries immediately buy the shipments, that as soon as Russian oil becomes available, Chinese and Indian buyers snap it up. So apparently, Russia has earned around $60 billion from its oil sales this month. And the month, of course, is not yet over. And the upswing altogether continues. What Ukraine has been doing in terms of its own drone attacks can only scratch the paint on the surface. They're not affecting the overall performance of the Russian economic machine. Now, compare that to what the Russians have just done with the port of Odessa and are likely to achieve with the destruction of the gas filling stations in central and eastern Ukraine and the oil depots there. They have effectively closed down Ukraine's entire maritime trade, which accounted for far and away the greater part of its exports and a very substantial part of its imports, including, according to the Russians and many other rumours, imports of military goods. So for Ukraine, the closure of the Black Sea ports has been an economic disaster of the first order. The destruction of the gas filling stations and the oil facilities in central and eastern Ukraine is not a disaster on the same sort of scale, but it will have an economic impact. And of course, it will also, in time, have an impact on the logistics of the Ukrainian military, though it is likely that the Ukrainians will always find some means to get diesel and gasoline through. But nonetheless, this will cause them long-term problems. There is simply no comparison between the damage that the Russians are doing to the Ukrainians and the damage that the Ukrainians are doing to the Russians. And on the Duran, Alex Christoforou and I did a program in which we discussed the folly of Ukraine's attacks on Russian grain ships in the Sea of Azov, which have resulted in the Russians now being given the excuse to attack Odessa, impose the sea blockade that they have never imposed on Ukraine, on the Ukrainian coast up to now. And to do so, moreover, against a backdrop of virtually no complaints from either the West or the Global South or Turkey or the United Nations Secretariat, all of whom combined to insist on the grain deal of July 2022. I would add that I understand that one of the reasons why the attacks on Odessa are not attracting the sort of complaints from the Global South that they once did is that the Russians have acted on the promises that Putin made back in 2022, that if there was an interruption in Ukraine's grain export trade, the Russians would make the difference. I understand that the biggest buyer of Russian grain is in fact Egypt, and Egypt continues to be supplied with the necessary amounts of grain by Russia. Russia also supplies India and other countries too, but apparently it still has enough to export to cover losses that countries suffer as a result of the interruption, the perhaps permanent interruption of supplies of Ukrainian grain. My guess is that all of these events, these attacks on Odessa, the interruption, the stopping of the Ukrainian food export industries, the biggest effect is going to be had in Europe, where we're likely to see food prices rise over the course of the autumn and winter, with no one, of course, in our governments or in our media willing to make the connection. Anyway, that's my view. Of course, I may be wrong. People are free to push back, but I can state my opinion, and that is the opinion that I have. Meanwhile, the Russians continue their offensive, and we now have apparently secure footage confirming that the Russian troops are indeed in control of Belitskaya in the Dobropilia area. And apparently, drone footage has also appeared, which shows Russian troops in the center of the town of Alexeyevo Druzhkovka to the south of Kramatorsk. This is not a huge place. If the Russians have already reached the center of this town, then it suggests that Ukrainian defenses there are crumbling fast. And also, it seems that the Russians are indeed now clearing and occupying the former salient that the Ukrainians controlled between Konstantinovka and Chasiv Yar, and that the Russians are pushing harder towards Nikolaevka and the Slavyansk thermal power station. But the most dramatic news on the military fronts appears to be coming from the Kharkiv region. And again, here we have further reports of a further Russian advance in Kharkiv region. The town of Beli Kolodias now seems to be essentially encircled by the Russians. I don't know whether there is still a Ukrainian, how large the Ukrainian military presence there is. But more importantly, the Russians are pushing beyond Beli Kolodias, and one can see a kind of pincer movement emerging with other Russian forces advancing westwards from the Russian border. And anyway, it looks as if the Russians are moving rapidly towards capturing a large territory in northeast Kharkiv region. And I think that is only going to be a small part of Kharkiv region, the small part of the Kharkiv region that the Russians will soon control. It's been suggested also, by the way, that if the Russians capture Belikolodyas and some small towns to the south, that will open another route for the Russians to use to advance towards the cities of Izium and Balaklaya, further south in Kharkiv region, immediately to the north of Slavyansk. Izium and Balaklaya were, of course, controlled by the Russians for a certain period in 2022. The Ukrainians recaptured them over the period of their Kharkiv counteroffensive. Well, as I said, if the Russians push south, apparently, that is an alternative route that the Russians have to recapture these two places, at which point the entire gains of the Ukrainian counteroffensive of the late summer of 2022 will have been completely reversed. Now, the general who was in command of that successful Ukrainian counteroffensive in Kharkiv in the summer of 2022, the only successful counteroffensive that the Ukrainians have conducted, the only general, the general who was in command then, was General Sirsky, who of course ultimately replaced General Zaluzhny as the overall military commander. In my opinion, it was the victory in Kharkiv that made Sirsky's reputation. And it was all the more impressive in that apparently General Zaluzhny, who was at that time the overall Ukrainian military commander, had doubts about the wisdom of the plan for the Kharkiv counteroffensive, which, however, was strongly backed by the Americans. Well, of course, Sirsky has now been sacked, and he has been replaced by General Drapaty. And out of interest, I've been looking to see what the Russians think about this. And I've also, by the way, received a very interesting email on the subject. And the general consensus amongst the Russians is that the Ukrainians have replaced a competent general. Sirsky knew his job. He may not have been a great military leader or a brilliant strategist, but he did understand war and did have a grasp of what he was doing. That the Ukrainians have replaced a competent general with a barely competent one. One report which I have read says that Drapaty's skills extended no further than those of a capable brigade commander. When he was appointed to higher posts, he struggled, and putting him in the highest post of all is obviously a major mistake. There are some different views about his role in defending Volchansk in the summer of 2024. Some say that he was able to pull together forces that successfully defended Volchansk in 2024 and prevented the capture of the town by the Russians in the first few weeks of Russia's summer 2024 offensive. I have some doubts about this. I remember at the time pointing out that the Russian forces, that group of forces North consisted of at that time, were relatively few, and that they already appeared to be somewhat overextended. And then, of course, the Russians had to deal with the further problem of the Ukrainian build-up, which led to the Ukrainian incursion into Kursk region, which group of forces north nonetheless, did manage to handle with a great deal of skill, just to say. But anyway, some do credit Drapati with that success, just as some people credit Drapati with the Ukupians' counterattack of last autumn. Well, I made known my own opinions about this. But others say that it was Drapati's incompetence which led to the extraordinary Russian breakthrough that took place in the Pokrovsk, in the north of the Pokrovsk area, with the Russians suddenly bursting through, capturing a string of villages, threatening Dobropilia itself. Apparently, Sirski blamed Drapati for his mismanagement of that and was furious with Drapati over it. And it was Sirski who had to make the decision to redeploy forces from all over, or from brought from all parts of the front lines, to plug the holes that Drapati had created. So anyway, the Russians have been talking about all of this, and they see this change in the leadership of the Ukrainian Defense Ministry and of the Ukrainian General Staff and of the Ukrainian High Command as a sign of the degradation, the slow motion collapse of the Ukrainian military as it confronts problems which are greater than those that it can cope with. And overall, I would say that the Russians seem to be pleased to see the back of Sirski. As I said, they did see him as a competent adversary, and they appear to be looking forward to taking on Drapati, who they don't put in Sirski's league. Well, that's the Russians. I'm not a best judge of these things, but anyway, I pass it on for what it's worth. Now, at this point, I am going to return briefly to the catastrophic failure of diplomacy that has taken place between Russia and the United States. And I mentioned in my program yesterday the very bitter statements that the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, has made about the situation, about the failure of the Anchorage agreement. And, well, he's almost unconcealed anger about this. Well, you can find the full comments on the Russian Foreign Ministry website, or you can also find them posted by Karloff F1, somebody who also writes a, also has a Substack site. But anyway, here is some of what Lavrov said. He said this: As for the failure of the Anchorage agreements, it is probably necessary to understand who exactly failed, because we came to Anchorage with the United States' proposals that had been submitted in advance, approved by US President Trump himself, and we took them into consideration. Not so long ago, President Putin reiterated at one of his news conferences that there were doubts, not immediately, but we thought about it and eventually we agreed. And then Lavrov continues, if there is a proposal and there is an agreement, then perhaps the agreed results were in Anchorage. There were. US President Trump said more than once, including in Anchorage, this is our proposal. Yes, it is partially a compromise. We accepted this because a compromise proposal and any agreement should probably contain an inevitable element of compromise. But Trump added, and this is again Lavrov speaking, Trump added that Vladimir Zelensky would do what he proposed. Well, it didn't work out that way. Yesterday, I conveyed to US Secretary of State Rubio President Trump's remarks in Alaska on the day of the news conference. Also, when he returned to Washington, President Trump, commented in enthusiastic terms on the agreements reached in Anchorage. He continued doing so for more than 3 days in a row. He said we had solved almost everything because one issue remained, but there was a basis for an agreement. We, the Russians, worked from absolutely the same position, proceeding from the premise that if we had accepted an American proposal, it will make it possible to stop hostilities and sit down at the negotiating table and agree a settlement. And then he said, Lavrov goes on to say, is this why President Trump's proposal failed? Because Ukraine would not do anything? Because the Europeans were not ready? They went to Washington immediately after the meeting in Anchorage and spent a long time processing the US administration. At the G7 summit in June, they adopted a declaration according to which the Westerners fully support Ukraine, including its territorial integrity, completely ignoring the fact that a huge part of Ukrainian territory is inhabited by people who have been declared terrorists by Ukraine's new commander-in-chief. And then he continues that if everything has failed, then to a large extent, it's Americans who must share the responsibility. And if Zelensky did not budge, and I'm quoting again his exact words, to a large extent, it is because of American assistance provided to Ukraine and indeed to Zelensky, because they sell weapons to the European Union, which sells them to Ukraine, but the Americans also provide intelligence, Starlink, etc. It is no coincidence that high technologies, which must be used on the battlefield, are also there. That is the situation. And anyway, Lavrov continues that since negotiations have failed and since there is no real possibility that negotiations will succeed, the Russians have no option but to continue the war until they achieved their objectives through a total military victory. Now, I think Donald Trump must have been shown this because these words of Lavrov's, because he then wrote his own True Social post, which was about the situation with Iran. Trump said that he had spoken to presidency of China, and presidency of China had assured him that China was not providing weapons to Iran. And he had also spoken to President Putin of Russia, who gave him the same assurances. Trump then continued that for his part, the United States does not supply weapons to Ukraine. It supplies weapons to the Europeans, it sells them, and it is for the Europeans then to decide what to do with them. Well, I have to say, I find that manipulative and tortious to the extreme. Surely Donald Trump, of all people, knows exactly what the Europeans do with the weapons that the United States sells to them. They transfer them to Ukraine. And of course, Trump very carefully avoids discussing the real point of grievance that the Russians have, which is that the Americans are providing targeting data and intelligence to the Ukrainians, without which the Ukrainians would not be able to conduct their drone campaign. And the Americans, via the Starlink system, are providing the Ukrainians with the communications facilities that enable the Ukrainians to control their drones as they operate deep inside Russia. So, whatever else he is, Donald Trump is not a naive man. He knows exactly what sort of support the United States is giving to Ukraine. And when he says that the Russians shouldn't really be supplying weapons to the Iranians because the Americans don't supply weapons to the Ukrainians, which is what his True Social post is essentially saying, well, he is being evasive and manipulative, or as we sometimes say in England, economical with the truth. I don't think the Russians will be impressed by any of this. Speaking of Donald Trump, there are now several reports, including from people like Robert Barnes, the US attorney, who will be hosting me in just 10 days' time, when I will be delighted to attend the 1776 convention in Chattanooga, to which we at the Duran have been very generously invited. Anyway, Robert Barnes, but also several others, are all saying the same thing about Donald Trump, that he is now becoming increasingly single-mindedly focused on the war in the Persian Gulf. He is furious with the Iranians because they didn't collapse or capitulate as he was assured that they would be, and as he believed that they would be. he is simultaneously furious with Prime Minister Netanyahu, who he feels led him into a war on the basis of false intelligence. And in his anger, apparently he is now focused exclusively on winning the war. He won't accept that victory against Iran is unachievable without enormous cost, a cost which America might not be prepared to pay. And for that reason, he continues to insist on more strikes and more attacks on Iran, despite the fact that the Pentagon is perfectly aware that these attacks on Iran are achieving nothing or very little. And supposedly, at least some of these reports claim that the truth about what is going on in Iran is now being kept back from Trump, that he listens mostly to a small, very hardline group of people within his administration who are telling him what he wants to hear, and that he still continues to get a lot of his understanding of the war and of the direction the war is taking. And by the way, the direction that the Ukraine war is taking from Fox News, which of course is an enthusiastic cheerleader for both wars, without of course having any formal responsibility for either of them. I'm afraid I think this is all plausible, entirely plausible, and it is disastrous if it is true. These reports also say that President Trump has also mostly given up on worrying about oil prices. And the word is that he apparently thinks that oil prices can continue to remain stable because the claim that the caverns in which the strategic reserve is held in the United States, that the caverns require oil inside them in the amount of 300 million barrels. Well, he's been told that actually that isn't true. He can continue to draw oil from the reserves right all the way down to 70 million barrels of oil without having to worry about any cave-ins or structural problems to the caverns. Well, I'm not a geologist. I know nothing about these things other than what I have read. I read in many, many places that it is in fact 300 million barrels of oil that has to be kept in the reserves, but before structural problems to the caverns begin. But I think we can see where this is going. President Trump is going to push way beyond that. He's going to disregard all concerns and reports about problems with the caverns. He's going to continue to draw on the reserves until they literally are completely depleted, which could take us quite a lot further in the war. Meanwhile, of course, refined oils, diesel and aviation fuel continue to remain short. Now, yesterday there was the first article in the London Times that also repeated the warnings I have been giving in program after program for several weeks now, that the situation with natural gas reserves in Europe is not good, that the reserves are unusually low for this time of year, and that there are growing difficulties in refilling the reserves because LNG supplies are going to Asia rather than Europe, so that the reserves are not being refilled. So the London Times mentioned that, and they also mentioned that there are accumulating problems with oil, that the oil prices, diesel, and aviation fuel will soon start rising as well. All of which is, of course, absolutely true. But notice that there continues to be no shift in the direction of policy. Nobody seems to be asking why, if we are running short of fuel, why, if energy prices are rising in the way that they are we turning our back on the one big major fuel resource available to us, which is Russia? Now, notice that this summer, when the Russians had problems with shortages of gasoline and shortages aggravated by panic buying and all of that, they were able to import gasoline. They imported gasoline from India and Kazakhstan and Belarus and other places. They had no problems importing gasoline from wherever it could be found. Whereas the European Union cannot import natural gas from the Persian Gulf because the Strait of Hormuz is closed and refuses to import gas from Russia. So there was a famous statesman who once said that he didn't believe in playing chess without the freedom to play on all 64 spaces on the chessboard. But the European Union will only play its game of energy chess with playing, it confines its game to only a small number of the spaces on the chessboard. It won't buy from Russia, and it can't buy from the Persian Gulf. A major gas exporter, well, I don't know about major, but a gas exporter is Azerbaijan. The Americans have complained about the Ukrainian attacks on Kazakh, and by the way, also Azerbaijanian economic assets on the Black Sea at the Caspian Sea, at the Caspian Petroleum Terminal. The Europeans have remained silent. Kaya Kallas still wants to seize Russian tankers on the high seas, which now extend to the Indian Ocean. Do these people in Europe know what they are doing? Are they actually planning to make an energy crisis, which now looms, are they actively planning to make it worse? Because sometimes it almost seems to me as if they do. In reality, of course, they remain fixated on helping Ukraine, as they call it, and on fighting Russia. Except, of course, that they're not helping Ukraine. I read a report by a statement by a Ukrainian government minister who is talking about the fact that millions of people have left Ukraine. And he slipped out his own estimate of the size of Ukraine's population, by which I think he means the size of Ukraine's population under the control of the Kiev government. And he put it at between 22 and 25 million. Ukraine, when the Soviet Union broke up, had a population of 51 million and was one of the most developed republics and one of the most industrially powerful republics of the Soviet Union. Well, to those who cheer on the war in the West, and of course there are lots of them, all I can say is, well, look at it now. And to those also who say that the war is a cheap and easy way to weaken Russia. Well, the realities, the economic realities, of course, tell us a completely different story. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say on those topics. I'm going to finish with a quick discussion about the enormously tangled German investigation of the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines, which took place in October 2022. Well, the official position across the West is that the attack was carried out by, I think it was six men and one woman operating from a boat, the Andromeda, and conducting deep dives far below the surface of the Baltic Sea, planting extremely advanced explosive devices in exactly the most vulnerable places of this enormously complex pipeline network, and in order to basically disable the pipeline network, and of course that all of these people supposedly were Ukrainians. The Germans have now taken into custody one of these six people. The others are in various places, and the woman, of whom many things have been said, there have been some attempts to make her into perhaps the most glamorous person in this whole operation. Anyway, about the woman, very little has been said indeed. There have been all sorts of attempts to link this operation to the former Ukrainian military chief, General Zaluzhny, who is, of course, now Ukraine's ambassador in London, in sullen exile, in effect, from Ukraine, where he is basically in opposition to the current president, the current leader of the country, President Zelensky. But anyway, this is the overall story that we are being told. And of course, we've had other accounts, like the one by Seymour Hersh, which gave a very different version of events, in which the attack was carried out by the United States, with the assistance of Norway and various other countries. And anyway, Seymour Hersh has given a much more, shall we say, complex and high-powered version of how the operation was done. I am not here going to discuss the truth or otherwise of all of these stories. What I will say is that I have absolutely no doubt that when the attack took place, several European governments were well informed in advance that something was happening, even if they didn't know the full details. And I am sure that in Ukraine, they knew exactly. And I suspect that the same is also true of some European governments as well. But anyway, it does appear as if the German prosecutors are now taking the prosecution that they brought seriously and have brought extremely serious charges against the one individual whom they have captured amongst this group. And interestingly, the German government continues to refuse to publish information about the results of the investigation. And the reason they're doing this is not because they deny that they have information which has not yet been disclosed, but because they say that publishing this information would affect Germany's national security and would potentially create problems between Germany and its allies. Now, I have to say, I find that extremely strange reasoning indeed. First of all, this was an attack on a vital piece of German economic infrastructure. Billions, hundreds of billions, had been invested in this project. And what we have seen in the years since, what the economic effects of the destruction of the pipelines on Germany and its economy have been. So saying that it is in Germany's national interest not to disclose information about who was responsible for this attack seems to me to ignore the fact that the attack itself was already a major assault on Germany's national security interests. And saying that publishing information might damage Germany's relations with its allies. Well, what sort of allies are they if in connection with an attack that destroyed a vital German economic asset in a way that affected Germany's national security, certainly its economic security, the matter cannot be discussed because it might upset those allies. I mean, what can disclosure of this information do which would be comparable to the hurt that Germany has already experienced? Well, I don't think most of you actually would have much difficulty answering the question of why the German government doesn't want to disclose more information about the Nord Stream attacks. Obviously, doing so would contradict the entire current direction of German foreign policy. It might remind the German people that the only big, major, actual attack on Germany that has been made by anyone so far was apparently carried out not by Germany's supposed enemy, Russia, but by Germany's erstwhile allies or friends. Anyway, with that, I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you again, you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, where we, by the way, have an ongoing sale. Last but not least, if you've liked this program, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.